Thank you. You may be seated. Our first case for today is 2025-20155, United States of America versus Antonio Ramirez Ramirez. We'll hear from Mr. Andino Renaud.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Mr. Ramirez presents three issues for the court's decision today. The first issue is what I would describe as a threshold issue, which is the Confrontations Clause analysis. If the court sides with appellant on this issue, it need not address the two sentencing issues. Proceeding directly to the Confrontations Clause issues, my understanding is that the government is relying on Corbello and harmless error in order to defend this judgment. The Corbello case is distinguishable from Mr. Ramirez's case for one very important factual reason. Unlike the Corbello case, where it was the confidential informant who sponsored the transcripts at issue, in Mr. Ramirez's case, it was the DEA special agent who introduced the transcripts and attributed them to the absent DEA analyst. That changes the analysis when it comes to who is the declarant. The jury had before them an absent witness, the DEA analyst, who implicitly certified that the transcripts were accurate. And this isn't a case that's about certification alone. Translation is a field of expertise. A translator, his job is not to juxtapose one word for another, rather to render meaning. And in that sense, it is core testimonial evidence.
Would we create a circuit split if we were to say that out-of-court translations are not governed by Crawford? Because the 11th Circuit has said they are governed by Crawford.
They are governed by Crawford, and I think that the government has conceded that they are governed by Crawford by arguing the Corbello opinion, which is 10th Circuit opinion. The United States versus Charles explicitly states that after Crawford, the language conduit theory is no longer valid as it applies to the Sixth Amendment. It may still be a good evidentiary case.
Are there any, is there already a circuit split on the issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so we were not create, we need to weigh in, but we haven't yet weighed in and there's already a split.
That's correct.
And you would encourage us to follow Charles and Charles's progeny?
We would, okay. Your Honor. We think Corbello is problematic. It is a 10th Circuit case. I can go into that in further detail if Your Honor would like. But appellant's position is that to the extent that Cordero even was a Sixth Amendment opinion, and I have grave reserves as to whether it even was a Sixth Amendment opinion, but to the extent it was and it relied on indicia of reliability and the Nazemian factors, it is fundamentally out of step with Crawford and its progeny.
Could this be harmless error?
No, Your Honor. Chief Judge, this was a very close case. The jury was instructed that a person does not become a member of a drug conspiracy merely by introducing a willing buyer to a willing seller. There must be more. In this case, the more came from these translations. The government introduced two written translations prepared by the DEA analyst. They are Exhibit 7A and Exhibit 12A. Although we objected to all of them, those are particularly instructive on the harmless error. Exhibit 7A was a post-transaction telephone communication between the defendant and the confidential informant. The translation said, and I quote, "It's that I feel bad, man, because I'm the one that set it up." That is powerful evidence of guilt. And it's evidence that the government relied on in its closing arguments, referred to it multiple times. Additionally, before the transaction, there was a text message that was exchanged between the defendant and his brother, who was the person who actually went and did the drug deal. That text message was translated as saying that he should be careful and that he should make sure he got, in effect, the money for the product. So those put together bring Mr. Ramirez within the ambit of the conspiracy where he otherwise wouldn't have been, and those were relied on by the government, and that's why we believe that the introduction of these transcripts was harmful.
And what does Mr. Davila believe it should be?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Your expert, who's the former translator in the Southern District of Texas, well-known former translator in the Southern District of Texas. What does he say it means?
As to the commentary that was, as to the telephone call after the transaction, he testified that he did not hear the words, "I set it up." He heard, and the CI actually confirmed this during cross-examination, "I set it up," or words to that effect, do not appear on that recording. The word that is used is I put, yo puse. And that, even if we got into the realm of translation ourselves, I put could mean I put you in touch with him.
Okay.
Just as easily as it could mean I put the whole thing together or I set it up.
Are the CI's recordings or the police cam video taken during the arrest, are these in the record somewhere? Because they don't appear to be on our U drive that we have.
Yes, I apologize.
No.
Before this hearing, the government and the defense agreed that the exhibit should be sealed to protect the identity of the confidential informant.
But are they part of the record and they just haven't been brought up to us? Or maybe they are, but they're put somewhere that no one's told us where they are.
They are part of the record. We called and confirmed just a couple of days ago. I don't know.
Okay.
We're
allowed to look at them, and that y'all both believe we should be able to look at them. You're shaking your head yes, and you've said yes. Okay. We just need to find them somewhere within our system if we wish to look at them and believe they're pertinent to this.
Yes, Your Honor. Turning to our second point, and as I mentioned, if the court agrees with the defendant on the translation point, this is a bit of a moot issue. We have an issue under the new sentencing guidelines, 1B1.3, which relates to acquitted conduct. Mr. Ramirez was acquitted for forcibly resisting the law enforcement officers who came to arrest him and of brandishing a firearm. Nevertheless, at sentencing, he was assessed a 2-point enhancement for threatening the officers who came to arrest him with a firearm. This is the core of what acquitted conduct is. The government is arguing that it falls within a safe harbor because the Sentencing Commission stated that acquitted conduct could be considered if it's necessary to establish the crime of conviction. In this case, the crime of conviction is alien in a possession of a firearm. The word establishing does a lot of work in the Sentencing Commission's guidance, and it's a reference to the elements of the offense. And the elements of the offense of possession of a firearm by an illegal alien do not require the government to prove anything about what was being done with the firearm at the time. Here, a jury decided that Mr. Ramirez was not guilty. They didn't specify for what reason, but it was a self-defense case. They specified that he wasn't guilty. And Judge Hittner wasn't free to substitute his own judgment for that of the jury when it came to that point. The final issue that we have relates to a 2-point enhancement for possession of a firearm in connection with a drug trafficking offense. This appeal turns on whether there was a spatial and temporal connection between the firearm and the drug trafficking conspiracy of which Mr. Ramirez was convicted. There was not.
Our case law is pretty generous about the spatial connection, isn't it?
It is very generous. But in this case, even that generosity doesn't suffice. And the reason for that is because the cash is nexus argument, right? The only argument the government has is they say there was cash found in the home. This court has never found that the mere presence of cash, untied to any testimony that it is the product of narcotics trafficking, is enough. The closest the court's ever come is the Castro case. And of course, the Castro case, the defendant admitted that his home was a hub for drug trafficking and that they were drug proceeds. So the court would be taking a step, we believe, in the wrong direction, but it would be taking a significant step if it were to hold in this case that the mere presence of cash in a person's home is enough to find, to believe by a preponderance of the evidence that they're a drug dealer.
Thank you. We have your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Christian Hamilton for the United States, and may it please the court. I want to begin with just discussing the 20HA that was filed last week, sort of specifies which arguments we're pressing and which arguments we're abandoning. The government's abandoning the argument that the transcripts were admissible pursuant to the language conduit theory. The government is not conceding that the language conduit theory would violate the Supreme Court jurisprudence. However, because we're not pressing it, that we think based on the facts of this case, it doesn't apply, this court doesn't need to reach that issue. Nevertheless, we're arguing two reasons why this court should affirm. I'll divide the transcripts up into two categories because it will make it clearer. The first is the transcripts related to the phone calls. Those we believe were properly admitted through the testimony of the CI. The CI was on the phone calls, he speaks Spanish, and he was able to testify that he reviewed the transcripts and the audio files and that the transcripts and the audio files were substantively correct, at which case the court did not abuse its discretion in admitting them, and then the CI was available for cross-examination. So as to those transcripts, the defendant's right to confrontation was not violated. Then there is the transcript that's from the text message. The government's argument on that issue is that the introduction of the text message—
They could cross-examine who? Whom?
They were able to cross-examine the confidential informant as to the veracity of the transcripts for the phone calls, because he was on the calls and he certified that the transcripts were accurate. So
does he have a translator certification?
No.
Or some sort of skill or ability in that area? Or you just mean he was a participant in the call and he could say what was said?
Because he was a participant in the call and because he is a Spanish speaker, he's able to testify as to what was said on the call to
him. He could testify as to what was said in the call, but he couldn't certify a transcript, could he?
Our view is that he can, under sort of
what case says that you can certify a transcript if you're not a transcript, you don't have a certification allowed, expertise.
So we're relying on the Curbelo case to make that point. In Curbelo, there's two sets of testimony. One is from an agent who certifies that the transcript is accurate, and also there's an individual who was on the call who certified that the transcript is accurate. Our position is that the certification by the confidential informant alone is enough in order to certify the transcript because he knows what was said
so
and what
it means
in English.
So a CI cannot just testify about what was said, which of course he can, and then he can be cross-examined on it, but he can also give an imprimatur of authenticity to an official transcript?
Yes, our position is that he's effectively, when he's saying I'm independently reviewing the audio and the transcript, that he's doing what would be akin to a retest, and that he's basically adopting the transcript as if he had made it himself.
And even though he doesn't have any expertise or abilities in this area whatsoever?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Who was he employed by?
The CI, the confidential informant. He was...
The translator.
The translator was contracted by the DEA.
Yeah. So someone had to approve his competence, I would think. How does that work?
So there's actually nothing in the record to indicate what the DEA process is for the translator. And our view is that's why there's really nothing in the record that would indicate there was some sort of implicit certification of the transcript by the DEA translator. In fact, I think on cross-examination, the case agent Emerson was asked specifically, is there anything in the record now that would show that these transcripts are accurate? And he replied no. So our view is that when he brought the transcripts in, there was no statement put to the jury about the accuracy. It was only through the confidential informant that the accuracy was established.
Okay, thank you.
As to the translation of the text message, there was no certification attached to the translation, nor did the CI testify that he reviewed the transcript. The court didn't allow sort of that type of testimony to be brought out. So while we do think it was entered in error based on those facts, we think it's harmless. One, because the text message itself came in, and the CI was able to testify based on his experience what the word dando y dando means, which means give and give. So the translation in that effect was cumulative of the testimony that the CI gave. And the text message, I think, what makes the text message sort of most inculpatory is that the CI testified that dando y dando means give drugs for money in the context of drug trafficking, and that's not in the translation itself. So the translation is not particularly damning. It is the testimony of the CI, which establishes why that text message is relevant to establishing the conspiracy. And so the translation itself, in our view, is harmless. I'll then turn to, unless there's any other questions about the translations, about the acquitted conduct. So I have sort of two points to make on the acquitted conduct. One, we view the what happened at the defendant's home at the time of the arrest helps to establish the conspiracy offense, because he had what were alleged to be drug proceeds in the home, and he was using a firearm, we believe, to defend them. And that helps to establish that that defendant was a drug trafficker. He was involved with drug trafficking, which would then go to prove his sort of knowledge and intent to join the conspiracy for the unlawful purpose of drug trafficking. And even though there might not have been money exchanged in this instant, the testimony was that defendant and his brother were able to supply upwards of 100 kilograms. So they were sort of considered to be sort of more prolific drug traffickers. So you would expect to find indicia of drug trafficking in their home, and that is circumstantial evidence that supports the underlying conspiracy charge. Also, regarding the possession, while the conduct that's necessary to establish that he was possessing a firearm is when he possessed the gun and caused the threat to the officers. So we believe that it's sort of encapsulated by the exception, and therefore the judge did not err in applying that exception.
Given that this is all brand new, do we have any authority to cite?
Not that I was able to locate. It's sort of an issue of first impression as to what the scope of the exception is. And then as to the firearm itself and the possession, our view is that relevant conduct includes conduct that occurs at the time of the arrest. And so the defendant was possessing the firearm when he was arrested for the conspiracy account. So it's properly applied. And also it's connected to the drug trafficking because he had drug proceeds in his home. They were alleged to be drug proceeds. That was the testimony from the trial, which the district court heard. So there was a reasonable basis for the district court to apply the enhancement.
Could Mr. Ramirez and his brother speak English?
I actually don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head.
You don't know?
No, I don't. I believe all of the conversations which we hear for them were in Spanish. So.
Right, but I don't know whether they were fluent in English with respect to the transcripts and the interpretation. It would be helpful to know if they were purely Hispanic-speaking people.
I don't know. I don't remember seeing that in the record. I know that the court specifically asked the confidential informant if he spoke English after he had confirmed that he spoke Spanish, and that whether he spoke and read English, and he confirmed that he did. So that's why we think he's in a position to validate the transcripts.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have your argument.
Thank you. Just some record sites to the extent they would be helpful to the court. The introduction of the disputed transcripts can be found at the record 1009 through 1010, along with the objection and the request to approach for sidebar. the CI's testimony where he states himself that he cannot hear "I set it up" anywhere on the transcript can be found at 1165 through 1166. The government's, one of the government's closing references to the transcript can be found at 1711 through 1712. And as regards the money that was found in the home, the testimony on that point can be found at record 1331.
Thank you. We have your argument. We appreciate both arguments and the cases submitted.